Russell Max Simon, welcome to Dirtbag Rich.
Thank you for having me, Blake.
Instead of starting with the question, I actually wanted to ask you to read an excerpt from one of your most recent posts on your wonderful publication, which is called Post Nomad. Would you do me the honor?
Sure. Greetings from Cornudella de Montsant. I am typing from the Renaissance Cafe in the center of town, a hot tea and a carrot cake on my table. A dozen old men play cards at the tables next to me. A climber sits at the bar. Cheesy Spanish music videos play on the flat screen TV on the wall. Outside, a light drizzle casts the town in a gray light. The reservoir that feeds the town water is filling. The cliffs where I climb are wet. This is now my home in Spain. There's a bed tucked into a tiny room where I can sleep well at the end of long work days. There is hot water in the shower, a toilet, and a two-burner camp stove on a countertop in the next room. A hammock hangs next to the stove, and a butane space heater fires up if I need to take the edge off the cold. Aside from these few spare comforts, my property here is down to the bones, crumbling concrete and plaster on four levels, and a pile of rubble in the back terrace. Open floor plans waiting to be filled by my labor and dreams.
You're a wonderful writer, and based on what I read here, it sounds like you're approximately 24 years old. You're a total dirtbag. You're camping out in a cafe in Spain, and you're sleeping, you know, in a room in a ramshackle house with almost no utilities or comforts, and you're waiting for the cliffs to dry out so you can go climbing. Is that essentially your life? Did I get it right?
So I'm 42. But to be honest, I actually feel like I have way more creature comforts than your average dirtbag climber. So in Cornudella de Montsant, there's all these van life people parked in the parking lot with no bathroom, no toilet, no hot water, also waiting for the cliffs to dry out. So from where I sit, I actually feel like I stepped it up a level. I actually bought a property in this town. And, you know, I've got a nice, comfortable queen size bed to sleep in at the end of the days. So, yeah, I guess it depends what your definition of dirtbag is, of course. But I actually feel pretty luxurious most of the time. And the hammock's really nice.
Russell, how did you end up here? Like, where specifically in Spain are you? How do you have this house? Like, just give me the recent history.
Sure. Cornudella de Montsant is in Catalonia, the northeast part of Spain. It is directly next to a massive climbing mecca, pretty world famous as far as the climbing community goes. And for many, many years, I had been traveling to Europe, not just to climb, but also to kind of explore the possibility of moving here and explore different towns, usually climbing towns. And, you know, I went to Greece, I went to Italy, I went to Spain a few times. 2 years ago, I took a trip to this climbing mecca near Cornudella de Montsant called Siurana, and I really fell in love with the area and the town and with Catalonia. I already had a soft spot for Spain and most of Southern Europe, but when I arrived here 2 years ago, I really felt like, oh, this is a town I could see myself spending a lot of time in. And after that, I started looking for properties and particularly wanted a fixer-upper because that's just how I roll. I wasn't going to spend a ton of money on some luxurious penthouse or anything. And I bought it a few months later and ended up moving here. So that's kind of the short story in recent history.
And I want to go back a little bit farther now. And one of the posts that you wrote that really endeared me was called Why You Should Stay in Place. And the subtitle was Digital Nomads Overemphasize Freedom and Misunderstand the Trade-Offs. And I was hoping you could tell me a bit about the analogy of the somewheres and the anywheres and what happened to you during the pandemic.
Yeah, I had always put freedom very high on my list of desires and values, and if not the highest place. I thought that, you know, having as much freedom as possible was really the thing that I should be optimizing my life for. And I thought that through most of my 20s and into my 30s. And I traveled a lot. You know, I've been to something like 45 countries in my life, many of them going back multiple times. And in 2020, I was in Mexico with my partner at the time, traveling, trying to improve my Spanish, and the pandemic hit. And like many people, I decided to go home. And at that time, I had just bought a house in the mountains of central New Hampshire. And yeah, like everyone, I was kind of stuck there for quite a long time. I didn't get on another airplane for a year. And a really strange thing happened, which is I had one of the best years of my life. First of all, everyone else who had bought homes in this small mountain town in New Hampshire was also stuck at home. And a lot of them were climbers like me. And we all decided to hang out with each other outside at campfires all through the year. You know, we were taking relative precautions, like we were bringing our own beer and bringing our own food and stuff like that. But we were socializing often. And meanwhile, I was climbing almost every day at the cliffs nearby. And it wasn't even a question of, well, where should I go next? Or how should I, what's the best place to live or anything like that? Because I was just stuck. And at that time, I heard a podcast that phrased it in terms of somewheres and anywheres. And anywhere is what I had been, which is to say I had remote income. I had been working remotely for years and years at that point, and I could go anywhere. And in contrast, somewheres were people who stayed in place. And I realized that being a somewhere actually was giving me all these things I had been missing. And probably the first one was social connection. Just being able to see my friends and my family and the people I love just all the time throughout the week was such a stark contrast to A, either traveling all the time, or B, living in Washington, D.C., where a lot of people had been focused on work and, you know, just making a coffee date with someone was kind of like a 6 weeks out type of thing.
Oh, my gosh. The threat is real. Yes.
Yeah. A lot of people in big cities experienced that. So I had a big transformation in 2020 towards realizing that staying in place and investing in place was actually the thing that I wanted to do more of in my life, and that I had been over-indexing on freedom. I had been assigning too much importance to freedom in my life and not enough importance to social connection. And from then on, I decided, look, I need to kind of shift the priorities and the values a little bit, stay in these places, invest in these places, which allows you to invest in relationships. And I think that's the thing that has been so wonderful since then.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about how you've made that investment, and I think you're doing it in a really special way and gratifying for both you and the other people around you. But first, I want to just question this idea that the pandemic, you know, revealed some truth of being rooted in place. It was a very special one-time event. Mm-hmm. In which everyone was forced by these huge external circumstances to stay. But then come, you know, sometime in 2021 and definitely in 2022, the world opens up again and it feels normal. You can travel everywhere. And in my mind, you know, we kind of rebounded back into modernity, back into we can be anywhere again. And so you don't have everyone else forced to stay in one place. Everyone else can then move and leave and do their own thing. And so what has your experience been of trying to be more rooted and place-based when the world opened up again and other people are free to leave and not be around to hang out at the campfire?
Yeah, I mean, well, the experience is that I'm just in the minority now, whereas during the pandemic, everyone was on the same page and in the same boat. And now here I am espousing these values of staying in place when there are a lot of digital nomads and increasingly work from home people who have this kind of new independence in terms of where they can choose to live, who are really trying to explore that. And that's fine. I did that for many years. But obviously I see some common threads in what they miss when they choose to move places every few months. And it always comes back to social connections and relationships, romantic or not. And I just like to encourage those people to think in the long term, well, what are they really trying to pursue at the end of the day? So, yeah, I mean, on one level, after the pandemic, and there was kind of a fracturing of that group that I had spent so much time with in New Hampshire, because some of them did go back to jobs. Some of them did move back to the cities where their primary home had been beforehand. And it was a bit sad. And in some ways, I'm somewhat nostalgic for that time. But I guess the main thing that's changed is that I'm just in the minority here again, in terms of being someone who is completely location independent, who at the same time like prefers to stay in communities where I can build deeper friendships and deeper, more meaningful relationships.
When we spoke earlier, you told me that when you were based in Barcelona last year and people would ask you, hey, I'm coming through, are you going to be here this time or that weekend? You just responded, yes, I'm here. I'm in Barcelona. I'm pretty much always here.
Yeah.
So even though you are still location independent in terms of your work, the marketing work that you do, you are choosing to be location dependent and you're choosing to take on these projects like renovating an old house that keep you in one place. And can you please now tie this into the climbing community and the role you've taken on?
The climbing community, it gives me so much. And I'm sure that it's, you know, the original dirt bags for all these climbers. So it's lovely to, you know, be some part of the community that originated this term. But the climbing community is an interesting thing. It's both international and completely tied to place, in that you have to climb cliffs that exist in a fixed location. So on the one hand, you can show up to any climbing area, and as a climber, I immediately feel that I'm a member of that community. I know the language, I know how to do it. We all need climbing partners to do what we love. So there's a natural cohesion that forms very, very quickly. But at the same time, like we have to go to a certain place to climb. So it's like a very rooted activity. And I think it's been wonderful for me to not just choose like a random place to go live in the world, but to choose a climbing mecca to go live in the world. Because, yeah, every climber that I've known in my 25 years of being a climber, you know, many of them may be spread out all over the world, but I can tell them the same thing that I was telling friends when I was in Barcelona, which is, hey, just come visit me here. I'm here. You can come here and do what you love, which is climbing. I'm here. We'll climb together. It's just an amazing way to knit together friendships that even among friends who are international and who are living in other places or traveling often.
And tell me about your life in New Hampshire and the hub that you've created there too. You've done some beautiful writing on this. I hope you can capture a bit of that evocative nature in spoken format.
What is so special about New Hampshire? I mean, when I was living in Washington, D.C. for a long time, I started originally looking for just kind of a second home near a climbing town. And the mountains of New Hampshire, the White Mountains, were kind of nostalgic for me. I was a camp counselor there when I was younger. I grew up in part in New England in September and October when the leaves change and all the mountains covered in forest turn orange and yellow. I honestly believe that if you are a climber who loves the outdoors, there is absolutely no better place to be in the world, in the entire world, than New England in the month of October. And where I bought the house in Rumney, New Hampshire, is the climbing mecca of New England. And what I thought was originally just going to be a second home to travel to and climb for a while really became my primary residence starting in the pandemic up until I moved to Spain. And yeah, what I found there again was just like an unexpected community that I didn't realize would give me so much. I also bought an old, like a really old farmhouse from, I think it was 1855 or something that it was built. And right when I moved in, stuff was breaking and it forced me to learn how to fix everything. Everything from plumbing and electrical to the well that was feeding the water to the house. We started a garden. I built a little climbing bouldering hut in the garage. I renovated the apartment into basically like a rental for climbers. Right now there's a full-time climber friend living there. And this house for me, actually, it became something that made me feel extremely wealthy. And because it was big and I was able to do the same thing, which is just to say, if you want to climb and hang out, come visit. I've got spare bedrooms. Bring some beer, bring your climbing stuff, and stay here. And for me, that became one of the main ways in which I really felt wealthy, was to be able to host people like that. I should say this house cost me $225,000, which felt ridiculously cheap in 2019, considering that's about what a studio apartment. It's less than what a studio apartment in Washington, D.C. costed at the time. And for that, I have this four-bedroom farmhouse with a detached, renovated apartment in the center of a climbing town. So yeah, owning that property just gave me a lot of things that were unexpected, and that really, really tied me there and helped build my community and made me feel extremely wealthy at the same time.
You and I are the same age, and I feel that we have an extremely high number of overlaps in experience and perspective. And what you just said about feeling rich because you can host your friends, I have definitely felt that. There's a number of summers in South Lake Tahoe, California, when I rented a small cabin and definitely paid more money than I'm used to paying for rent. But I could just ask six people to come over and crash or host a dinner party, throw people in a tent in the backyard. Where I'm recording right now in Vienna, I got a larger than necessary apartment so that I can host dance friends who come to dance events in Vienna. And I had five or six of them in the apartment over the weekend as well. It's extremely gratifying. And it's also a symbiotic relationship, right? You need to have these friends who are able and willing and desiring to come and travel and crash with you. Can you just tell me a bit about your experience building up a meaningful community? Because it seems like that is really a huge value for you. And maybe tie this into your earlier phase in life when you were in DC and living more of a traditional life.
Yeah, I mean, I first moved to DC in my 20s, I think mid-20s, or I was 24, 25 or something. And I did it, you know, for my career, which is pretty much why everyone moves to DC. And DC was really good for my career. I moved up organizations. I was working at important, prestigious think tanks. I was working on political campaigns. But I just think, like most really big cities, especially one where people are so focused on their careers, like a place like DC, it just becomes so hard to, I think, maintain really deep, meaningful relationships with people outside of work. And two things happened when I was living in DC. One was I stopped working in politics and activism, and so therefore didn't really have a connection to that aspect of DC anymore. And the second thing that happened was most of the friends that I had there ended up moving away, usually because they had kids. And so they would go someplace cheaper where they could have a bigger house and a yard and do that American dream sort of thing. But the point is, bit by bit, I felt a real disconnect from Washington, D.C., because I was no longer interested in pursuing that kind of career. I was much more interested in being my own boss and making my own hours and having more control over my time. And second, just people moved away because of the high cost of living. And on top of that, you have to drive 5 hours from Washington, D.C. to get to any cliff to climb that is even remotely worth, spending time and energy on. And I secondly to climbing, I also love to go to the beach and kite surf once or twice a year. That was a 3 hour drive away. So the things that I really love to do that I wanted to start orienting my life around, which was these outdoor activities and spending time with people I love, my friends and my family, I just could no longer do there in DC. It just did not feel like a place that was conducive to that at all. Through the culture, because of the physical environment, because of all of that stuff. And yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, tell me how you make friends, because you described how in cities everyone's super busy, it's hard to even have coffee. And then people have families or their partners and they maybe move away to for lower costs. And I just feel like loneliness and isolation is becomes the default and the norm, and having people spontaneously show up and crash at your place is relegated to a long ago memory. And so how did you transition into having a very fulfilling community, which it seems like you do have now?
Yeah, I honestly, moving places was how that happened, and moving places specifically to a climbing town. Whenever I see location-independent people kind of, talking about their loneliness, their disconnection from people, this is just my first most basic 101 question is like, what is the activity that you're doing that you're passionate about? And they're like, well, I'm trying to go to co-work spaces to, and meet people there, or I'm on the dating apps, I'm trying to meet people there. And I'm thinking to myself, all right, you work on a laptop and you want to go sit in a coffee shop with 20 other people with their faces in a laptop, and that's how you expect to build friendships and community. It just doesn't make that much sense to me. People need to find a community. For me, it's rock climbing. It's really easy to show up at a climbing area, including in New Hampshire, and find climbing partners. And after you climb together, you have a beer together, and you have a potluck together, and the community grows from there. And if they're not around, you say, hey, do you know anyone who needs a climbing partner? And the group builds and the community builds. So for me, it's climbing, but I think for anyone, it just needs to be like find that passion activity and go do it, and not like do it here and do it there, but really commit to it. Like go to a place where everyone who loves that thing is also doing that thing. And if you
Yep.
can't make friends in that environment, I mean, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, therapy. I get the feeling, I'm sure someone else has written very extensively about this, that climbing is unique in its community aspects. I mean, just the fact that you need someone to belay you the fact that there's a limited number of high quality places to climb, and so people tend to cluster. I'm not sure if it's quite the same for trail running, for backpacking. What about kite surfing? Do you find a similar level of community through that activity?
Yeah, there's interesting things that kite surfing and rock climbing share. One of them, well, the obvious one is you have to go to a place to do it, and people do cluster in those places. So for kite surfing, it's windy, sheltered coves around the world. Like anywhere that used to be a windsurfing place is now a kite surfing place. So you have to go to a place. You're going to find other kite surfers there. If it's windy, there's always going to be kite surfers on the beach. Another thing that it shares with climbing is you kind of do need another person in kite surfing. You need them to launch and land your kite. It's not really something you can do by yourself on the beach. So you need to talk to people when you get to that beach, and that kind of naturally lends itself to other conversations. You're always talking about the conditions. How does the wind look? How do the waves look? What size kite are you flying? And then usually when people are done kite surfing, they're pretty spent and they want to go for a drink or a pizza or whatever it is. So I get that not every passion, like trail running, for example, naturally lends itself to this, but many do. You know, you're a dancer. That community certainly lends itself to this. For many people, it's food or cooking. You know, obviously you can meet people that way in cooking classes, going to different spots and cities where you can learn about that in markets and stuff. So yeah, I mean, if your passion is a completely solitary pursuit, you're going to need other strategies. But I would advise someone that if you are a digital nomad and you're location independent, then please experiment. Try to go find a passion that you do with other people.
I want to start a spinoff podcast now about like dodging loneliness and building community through appropriate shared activities. Okay, that's for a later time and place.
We'll just note that. Yeah.
We'll note that. We'll come put back a pin to that. In that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to ask about how you fund this life, but before that, I want to ask, like, how do you actually spend your time on a day-to-day basis? Maybe you can give like the Spain prototypical example. You can give me the New Hampshire prototypical example, but how is your time distributed among work and play and community and family?
Yeah, well, you know, the Spain and New Hampshire are pretty similar. In both places, I have a house next to a climbing crag. And in both places, I spend a lot of time working on the property. Like I said, the New Hampshire farmhouse has things that are going wrong all the time. There's building projects. So a pretty typical day for me is doing some reading and writing in the morning. I have my Substack newsletter, so sometimes I'm writing that. Sometimes I'm working on a book manuscript that's been ongoing for several years. In the afternoons, I am either climbing or building something. That's a pretty good bet. So in the case of Spain, I would be working on the renovation project. And evenings, you know, spend time with family, spend time with friends. I have a 14-year-old kid, so he's with me half the time. When he's with me, obviously, I'm spending a lot of time with him when he's not in school. In terms of work, it really is the case that my answer about work keeps going down in terms of how much time I spend on it. I used to say 20 hours, but that was maybe 5 years ago. I think at this point, it's honest to say I'm spending about 5 to 10 hours a week on paid work that's earning me money. And I try to confine that to, you know, a few days here and there. I try to get most of the client work that I have to do in a given month done early in the month. So ideally I have maybe a week or 10 days at the end of the month where there's almost no work to do, no paid work. That's basically the time.
That sounds pretty darn ideal, Russell. Like when you start it, you're like, I do some writing in the morning and I work on the house. I hang out with nice people. I was like, where is the paid work in this equation? Yeah. What is your work and how, I mean, I'm assuming it must be quite well paid on an hourly basis in order for you to just do 5 or 10 hours a week and to be able to maintain properties and travel.
Yeah. I mean, I had a pretty normal career from, you know, age 22 to maybe age 34-ish. Although when I was 30, I got laid off. I'm just giving this sort of brief background about how I got to being able to do this. It didn't come out of thin air. But when I was 30, I got laid off from this think tank and started marketing consulting. Just because it was the easiest way to quickly make money. My son had just been born. I definitely needed to make money. And since 30, 31 years old, I have not been to an office full time. At one point, one of my marketing clients hired me, and I became a full-time employee of quite a big physicians group. Company in the US. I was their director of marketing. But I still did not go into the office. First of all, there were a lot of doctors, so they were never in the office either. And I had already been working remotely since they were a client before. So I just continued working remotely, only that time as an employee. That company did a big restructuring a long time ago, and I went back to marketing consulting full time. Except that I essentially had a network, a professional network from the years previous and from this company that I'd worked at. And so now I have various clients, most of them in healthcare in the US, and I do content marketing or marketing strategy for them. And yeah, I can charge a decent amount. I do flat fee contracts for all my clients. So it's a set amount of money per month for a set amount of deliverables per month. That's really important to me because it disconnects income from time. And I don't want to be in the position of trading my time for money because that would just incentivize me to work more hours. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to work more hours. I want to work fewer hours. So... the flat fee retainer contracts are really important to me. And I do those deliverables. I have client calls, you know, maybe once or twice a month with each client, but they're pretty efficient. They go pretty quickly. And I've just become quite good at the job. And, you know, it's marketing and content marketing is something I've been doing for a long time at this point. And combined with the professional network, I'm able to charge pretty well for it. And since I'm my own boss, I can control my meetings and control the hours. So all of that adds up to, and I must add that AI tools have made me way more efficient in the past 3 years. I am able to do a lot more in less time.
Thank you for standing up for AI.
I mean, it's going to change stuff whether we like it or not. And I embraced it pretty early and saw that it could help me. And at the same time, started giving my clients advice on how it could help them. So,
yeah, you're riding the wave. And for those who are kind of curious about your mysterious background in your 20s, like what... Maybe don't give me the full history, but just tell me, like, what skills did you build and how were you able to develop this network of potential clients that lead you to the state that you ended up in your 30s? Like, what really made a difference in you being able to land where you are now, working 5 to 10 hours a week and getting paid quite well?
That's a good question, Blake. I often... And if someone asks me that, I tend to mention my graduate degree, which is from a somewhat unique college in the US called St. John's College. And it's unique in that they do this great books, classics of Western philosophy program. So I have a master's in philosophy from St. John's College. And I think the the real value that I got out of that education was this weirdly insane self-confidence that I can learn anything that needs to be learned. Because basically you're reading from the most difficult philosophical texts of the last 2000 years and making them accessible. In some ways, the skill translates to doing marketing and journalism. And so that was actually my first job, was as a reporter. And the local newspaper hired me while I was in this program. And it was basically the same set of skills, which is interviewing experts about things and then translating them into just the written word and making it accessible and telling the story. But I think I knew from that education that like I could kind of fake it till I make it in a lot of different realms. And when I moved to Washington, D.C., I stopped being a journalist and started doing marketing and communications and press. And like I said, I kind of worked in politics for a while. To be honest, a lot of that professional network from politics is completely gone and lost to me now. Like I severed ties and almost burned some bridges. I got so disillusioned with that world that I actually burned some bridges on purpose because I didn't want to do it anymore. And when I started doing marketing work at around, like I said, around when I turned 30, 31 or so, I was marketing in business, not in politics, not in advocacy. And I just found like doing business to be like in some ways more straightforward. Like, I'm going to do work for you. You're going to give me money. That's the agreement. And
what was the agreement when you were doing political marketing?
Well, the problem with politics and advocacy and nonprofits, which is the business that dominates a lot of Washington, D.C., is that the like metrics for success are like very unclear. And I was especially working in climate politics and that kind of advocacy, where like the metric for success was we want to save the world from climate change. Well, how do you measure that? And we were never, and everyone in an organization kind of thinks their job is the most important job. But since it's a nonprofit and you're not earning money, you're only asking for donations, you don't actually have like a feedback loop that makes that everyone is on the same page with. Mm-hmm. Whereas like in a business, I mean, I have a mixed relationship with capitalism, right? Like I want to escape it essentially, but I want to like use it to escape it. And I think it was more comfortable for me to just be in a place where everyone understands the point of this organization is to turn profit. And if you can contribute to that happening, great. And if you can't, you know, I'm sorry, but like you need to find something else to do. And that just like doesn't exist at nonprofit organizations and within advocacy campaigns. You're judged much more on like how many hours you're spending in the office, frankly. And at the think tank in DC where I was working, it was like, well, if you spend 12 hours sitting at your desk, you must somehow be contributing to this organization. And I was looking it around and thinking to myself, are they contributing to the organization? Like I read their white paper, it's nothing special, you know? And why did it take them 4 months to write this thing in the first place, you know? And so I became quite disillusioned with organizations that function like that. And was just much happier when I could work directly with businesses where, you know, like if a client fires me because I'm not helping them make money, I'm like, totally, that's fine. You know, no, nothing personal.
Yeah. Yeah. I failed. I deserve to be fired.
Yeah.
So on the scale of purpose or meaning, did you start out hoping that you would derive meaning by working in for advocacy type organizations?
Yes.
Then I'm getting the feeling that that transitioned into I'd rather just have a very clear relationship with the people who are paying me money.
Yeah.
And do you feel less, do you derive less meaning from your paid work now?
Yeah, I mean, my paid work is not helping to save the world in any way, shape, or form, I'm pretty sure. It's helping mostly doctors who have started their own companies to, either get more contracts to provide more healthcare or to get more patients in the door. I don't know if that's helping, fix healthcare in America or not, but yeah, I definitely use business and profit and capitalism to free my time to find a meaning in other places. And you're right. I did originally, when I was in my 20s, enter the workforce thinking to myself, like a lot of young people, I need to find my life's passion and it needs to be my job. And as long as my job is purposeful and meaningful to me, it won't feel like work. The problem with that is just, like I already detailed, I started feeling a real disconnect from the words that these organizations were using to describe their mission and the actual efficacy of the work itself, not to mention the efficacy of all the people working in those organizations. It just struck me that we hadn't yet solved climate change. We weren't going to solve climate change. The only really thing that we needed to do in order to do that was to win a bunch more of elections. So if you wanted to go work on those elections, I think that was purposeful and useful. But the whole nonprofit advocacy complex in the US felt to me like mostly producing a lot of reports to convince donors to give us more money to pay our salaries so that we could produce more reports
Ooh.
to convince donors. It was a
Ooh.
circular thing and it started feeling not good to me. So when I left that, you're right, I started finding meaning in other places, in investing in the communities, buying and renovating properties, developing meaningful relationships, hopefully, maybe giving back to the climbing community in some way, helping to support that.
And you feel at peace with this balance? Like finding meaning in community and shared activities and places rather than your paid work.
I do. I really do. For me, it's just my version of like being able to sit in a truth that feels like the most honest to me. Like the most honest thing for me to do is to like have a business relationship that's just a business relationship and not pretend that we're family, not pretend that we're saving the world through this business. Not do any of those pretend things that sometimes you see, and instead to like do, spend as much of my personal time as I can doing the things I love with the people I love. I think it took a few years for me to recognize that there was a use to the world in that lifestyle. Like I'm not just selfishly climbing all the time. I am at the end of the day taking properties that were basically sitting there derelict, unlivable, and turning them into livable properties for the climbing community. And each time I do that, at least I think to myself, yeah, I've contributed to my community. I'm providing housing. I have fixed something that was broken. There is a housing crisis. I'm piece by piece, helping to create more places for people to live. It so happens that these people are my friends, that they're climbers. And that feels really, really good. I want to keep doing that, more of that.
Tell me how this all connects to, you mentioned the people you love. And so whether these are romantic partners, whether this is your child, I know you co-parent with someone, an ex partner. And moving into this post-nomad phase, the New Hampshire house, the Spain house. What is life like for you? Maybe just start with romantic relations. Tell me about your love life, Russell.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, the love life is always the thing that suffers if you move around so much. And, just like the posts that you see on Facebook and digital nomad forums and everywhere are just like, well, how do you date? Why do I feel so disconnected? How do I fix this? And it's just like incredibly difficult to expect someone to follow you around the world doing exactly the things you want to do, especially if you just met the person. So anyway, to answer your question, like I met a climber 2 months after I met 2 months after I moved to Barcelona, and we became friends. And a few months after we had been friends and climbing together, we started dating. So we've been together about a year at this point. That's the romantic story. I think it could only happen by committing to living here. Otherwise, maybe you can have some short-term casual relationships and that's fine. But yeah, my preference is a meaningful partnership, someone you can share life with. That's the answer to the romantic question.
What happens when you go back to New Hampshire?
When I went back to New Hampshire, I begged her to come visit me for as long as she could, and she did. She came because I promised her amazing climbing in New Hampshire, and so she came and climbed for a while, and thankfully was able to work remotely from her job for a while doing that. So we were apart from each other for a little bit while I was in New Hampshire, but she also was there for part of that time as well.
And just to dwell on the romance a bit more, Russell, do you think that something like this could work with a non-climber? It feels like, your life is very oriented. Where you want to live is related to climbing, your friendships, your community. Do you feel like you're all in on the climbing community, like 360 degrees, all the relationships?
I've thought about that a lot. Before I met her and I was single, this was probably the main question I had in my mind. And I was dating people in Barcelona right when I moved there, but every weekend I was climbing. Like that was always the same answer. What are you doing this weekend? I'm climbing. And that was always my preference. But I think the answer at the end of the day is that I think it would be fine to develop a relationship with someone who's not a climber. I mean, it's not all my time. It is the bulk of my like free outdoors time, and it's definitely been incredible to be with someone with whom I share that passion a lot. And every day out at the climbing crags is a good day, even if we've had a bad day in our work life or our personal life or whatever. And so it's amazing to share that passion with someone. On the other hand, I've met plenty of climbing couples who it's like combining your work with your passion. Like they kind of mix with each other in a kind of an unhealthy way. They bring their relationship problems to the climbing crag, and then they realize that like they're not having fun climbing either. And that's really not that good. Like And so I think it could go either way. If I were to date someone who didn't climb, it's fine. I would like to share some other passions with them. I don't just want to like be sitting there having dinner and drinks, and that's the only thing we share. I want shared loves. But yeah, they would just have to understand like, hey, I'm gonna be out doing this thing for, a sizable number of hours each week.
And tell me about your co-parenting relationship and how your 14-year-old fits into your life and whether there's any kind of conflict there with the lifestyle you're trying to lead.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, my son is what kept me in the DC area for a really long time. I was pretty committed to being a 50-50 co-parent with my ex. We split up when he was 1 year old. So it's pretty much always been a co-parenting relationship, and that's always been his reality, was going back and forth between the two homes. When I was living in Washington, D.C., it was a pretty traditional 1 week, 1 week. kind of split, aside from summer vacations, winter vacations, you know, which would be kind of alternating, which is a pretty typical way to split up a co-parenting relationship. When I was looking at moving to Europe, and when I ultimately finally bought this property, the original plan had been to have my son go do a study abroad with a family that we know in Germany. And both his mother and I were really supportive of this idea. We thought it would be great for him. She really supports international experiences as much as I do. At the end of the day, that ended up falling through. And so my proposal was, well, why don't I take him to Spain with me? And that's how we ended up in Barcelona. And I found a great international school that he really loved and thrived in. He loves soccer/football. He especially loves FC Barcelona. And he really loves traveling and new cultures and experiences. So yeah, he ended up coming with me to Spain for that year. And at the end of that year, you know, I had a discussion with his mom, what's next? It was clear she really missed him. And so it seemed reasonable. Okay, let's have him go back to the US this year. I'm going to stay in Spain. I'm going to go work on this renovation property full time. And we'll probably have another conversation like that at the end of this year. He's old enough at this point that, you know, obviously his opinion starts to matter more and more. And I know that when I turned 14, I was basically out of the house from then on. I went to boarding school. I was traveling even in my summer vacations. Mostly I wanted my independence and to go explore the world. So we'll see what happens. But it's always been a pretty good relationship with his mom. And we've been pretty good at working together to give him amazing experiences throughout his childhood. And sadly, there's not that much of it left. And but I hope to keep providing him with cool experiences as much as I can.
Yeah, and it's great that he seems so receptive to traveling, living abroad.
Adventure. Yeah, he loves it. Yeah.
Something else that you wrote in that wonderful post, why you should stay in place, was about money and about the idea that having too little money is not free. That's not a form of freedom. Almost everyone mm-hmm. knows that. But also having too much money is not a form of freedom. And you just have very interesting, nuanced thoughts about the role of money in your life. And what you said earlier about wanting to be very careful to not equate money with time, because then you know that you will feel like maybe you should spend more time working. Like, that's a very high level of self-awareness there. And so just tell me a little bit more about this too little money is bad, but too much money is also bad from the perspective of freedom.
I think I got that, with due respect to Nassim Taleb, from his book Anti-Fragile.
Yes.
He was talking about different professions and which of them could be fragile versus anti-fragile. Anti-fragile just meaning it's not just the quality of resilience, but it's the quality of actually being able to grow and thrive when things are chaotic around you. Writers are one of his prime examples. So, you know, the more kind of the world is going through chaotic times, the more writers are called on to do their work and to explain what's going on to people. But it applies to money, because the way you have to get so, so wealthy usually involves building a business of some kind. But when you build that kind of business, you take on any number of these commitments. Maybe you take on investors. Now you're beholden to your investors. Or maybe you take on employees. Now you have a responsibility to your employees. Maybe you go public. Okay, now you have regulatory responsibilities. Some of my clients, a lot of them are doctors, and they're very wealthy, and they've run their own businesses, and they are extremely tied to responsibilities related to these businesses, whether they're on the board of some big medical organization, or they have you know, professional standards and guidelines that they need to be very conscious about in terms of their personal behavior and their standards that they follow. So You know, it's not that like having $10 million in the bank somehow ties you, like restricts your freedom. It's that the methods of getting that much money sitting in the bank necessarily commit you to things that end up restricting your freedom.
Mm-hmm. What have you said no to? What have you walked away from that could have taken you in that direction, but you said, no, I value having real choices, real options, and more freedom and flexibility?
Full-time jobs. There's a lot of people I work with who are, you know, marketing directors inside companies, which is what I was 10 years ago. And you could work your way up, become a VP of marketing, become a chief marketing, you know, just work your way up a corporate ladder. I could have kept doing that. I also could have kept doing that at nonprofit organizations or in politics or whatever it is. I have walked away from job offers. I have walked away from jobs. I've walked away from even clients who wanted a particular, you know, like, for example, an hourly contract instead of a flat fee contract. And at the same time, I guess I've walked away from doing business development. I don't even really spend that much time trying to find new clients. I'm fortunate enough to just mostly have referrals and have a lot of longstanding relationships that want to keep working with me. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of ways in which I could have earned more money by working my way up in the American economy, but just chose not to.
Again, I feel very aligned with you. My little travel company for unschooled teenagers, I essentially stopped developing the business, like, I don't know, 2 years after I started it. And I just said, as long as enough people keep signing up for enough of the programs that I really want to offer, then that's great. I'm chill. And once I got to a point of being able to make like a satisfying amount of money on each trip, I said, that's it. No more.
Yeah.
And it's a bit shocking to some people when you don't seem growth oriented or you're perfectly happy to just coast, because it's almost like an alarm for many people. It's like either you're growing, or if you're not growing, you're dying, or you're not investing in your business. And so it might not be as strong as it could be 5 years from now. How do you combat that sense of like anxious, always squirreling away more resources for the future, the future orientation, maybe even tie this into your history as a goal setter, Russell?
Yeah, this is when I first started out on my own, and I think one of the big decisions with if you're your own boss is, do you want to try to grow the business or not? And I think I decided pretty early on that I wanted to grow the business to the extent that I could still do it myself. I didn't want to grow the business to the point where I needed to hire someone. That was not something that I felt comfortable doing. I did not want to make this like random life experiment that I was doing for myself. Like I didn't want to make someone else's financial livelihood dependent on my business.
Amen.
So that was kind of the limit that I set for myself. And at first I felt a little odd, but slowly by slowly, I was writing, and I started writing the newsletter Post Nomad. And I remember when my first client or my first ex-colleague signed up for it, you know, a doctor who was pretty high up in the organization and who I had worked with for many years. And I thought to myself, oh my God, what's this person going to think? They're going to read all my writing about seeking meaning in other places. And, you know, will they even give me continue to give me their business? And the truth ended up being that they were just kind of jealous that, you know, this person loved to surf, but like me was very far away from a surfing beach and could only do it once or twice a year on a family vacation, and wished that he could do it more often, and just envied the life that I had set up for myself. And once I started realizing that that was actually the more common reaction, I started relaxing a little bit. to be honest, the more difficult thing for me has been explaining this to my son. because my son has grown up with so much privilege and wealth all around him. I mean, we lived in one of the wealthiest counties in the US and right outside Washington, DC. And, you know, his mom's family makes really good money and has plenty of wealth. And everyone that he's at school with makes plenty of money and has lots of wealth. And they all live in really big houses, and like gigantic ones, and they're driving Teslas and, you know, gigantic Jeep things, you know, that are designed to cross rivers, and they're driving them around the suburbs. And my son is looking around wondering why I've decided to rent kind of like the smallest house in the neighborhood and why I drive a used Honda and why I spend like most of my time like climbing. And I think he would always ask me like directly, like especially when he was eight years old, nine, 10 years old, like, "Daddy, why don't you make more money? Like, why don't you go try to make more money? Like, why don't you go get more business?" And I just had to explain to him over and over and over again, like, "I have enough money, kiddo. Like, you see how much time I'm spending doing things I want to do? Like, it's most of my time. Like, what would I do with more money?" And then he would say, "Well, you would buy a Tesla." And I'm like, "Yeah, those are cool, but like, I really like my Honda. It's totally fine. I drove across the country in it. I don't, even if I had $1 million, I wouldn't spend 100,000 of it on an expensive sports car." This is the main challenge, to be honest. It's the main cultural, like wave that I felt like I was swimming against mostly, was making my son okay with this idea that, that I really do feel wealthy and really happy and fulfilled with less money than all the other people who were our neighbors there, you know?
That's one of my biggest cultural fears around the idea of becoming a parent, which is the expectation that comes from other parents, but especially from your own kid and from other kids, about like, you need to be visibly consuming as much as like the other people in our community. Otherwise something is wrong.
Yeah.
Sounds like that's what you're describing.
Yeah, 100%.
Final question, Russell. You and I are both Americans who have decided to spend a lot of time in Europe. What is it for you about Europe? And of course, Europe is many things, so you can tell me about specific places. What is it that captivates you and keeps you there and keeps you in love with this place?
I have always been very partial to Southern Europe. And it's not that Northern Europe isn't nice and lovely and beautiful, but it seems to me that Portugal, Spain, Italy, Greece, etc., that the people here have decided to just shift the balance of their culture toward quality of life in the form of social connection and away from wealth seeking and workism and long hours. And that's the central core thing. And obviously that's helped by the weather. You know, it's really nice. You can be outdoors a lot of the time in any of those places. And when you can be outdoors a lot of the time, that means you can sit with friends outdoors for a lot of the time. And that's what you see here is, you know, coffees or beers with friends not taking a half hour, an hour, but taking 4 or 5 hours. And that's amazing. It's these people have conversation skills that I don't have as an American. I'm like, how do you keep that going day after day? And I think the answer is like, that's baked into their culture is having a more just having more of a focus on community and social connections than we do in the US. There's a weird quirk about the Spanish social safety net that I learned a few months after moving here in my Spanish class, which is that the government actually subsidizes vacation time for retired people in the off season, because they just so are interested in making sure that as you grow older, you have the time and the resources to spend time with your friends and your family. And so you have all these 60-70-year-olds, you know, traveling to Mallorca and spending a lot of time together. And it's wonderful to see that in the small town where I am, in Barcelona, almost anywhere you go, you're going to see this. And to say to anyone here, oh, I am making things that I love to do my priority, and that thing is not my work, is just like a super ordinary thing for everyone to say here. You know, like they work and then they take a lot of time off, and no one is walking around saying to themselves, oh, how's life? Oh, I'm really busy. Oh, great. You're busy. That must mean everything's good, right? No, no one says that here. You know, here it's, oh, I work. I'm looking forward to the weekend so I can go do the things I love. And everyone's like, yeah, me too. That's what we all do here, you know? And you just don't find that so normalized in the US.
I remember reading some little illustrated book kind of from an anarchist perspective a long time ago. And there was a single cartoon, like a 6-panel cartoon. And one person, they're having tea or something. One person asks another, what do you do? And they say, oh, they list a job title. And they say, what do you do? And it's like, well, I sew, I hang out with my cats, I cook meals for my friends. And they're like, no, what do you do? Mm-hmm. You know, and they're like, that is what I do. And, you know, I'm sure there's also something they do for money, but just flipping that upside down and responding to the question, what do you do, with like the actual activities that you care about and you prioritize and you look for. I sit in and talk with my friends for 4 hours over 1.5 beers.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is what I do. And I also do some other stuff to make money and contribute to society. But
yeah,
that's not number one.
There's a meme that I saw between a European workplace and a US workplace, and the US workers basically writing an email saying, haha, Europe, we beat you in GDP growth, wealth creation, stock market, lower inflation, haha. And he gets an auto reply from the European worker that says, I'm sorry, I'm out of the office for the next 6 weeks and won't be back until the end of September. I'll get back to you.
Yeah. How can people find your writing and any other information about you online, Russell?
It's all at Post Nomad, which is at russellmaxsimon.com. That's where all my writing is, and you can reach out to me there.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been wonderful.
Thanks, Blake. It was really fun.